On this week's 51%, we spend the show with author Marie Benedict.
I think from my perspective, I found it more fulfilling, and I found myself more capable of getting into the interior of these women's lives in a way that I hope connects with readers. I found it easier to do that through fiction.
I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. No, I don't want to sit still, look pretty. You get up on a 9-to-5 dream, but picket fences and trophy wives. But no, I'm never gonna be, cause I don't want to be. No, I don't want to sit still, look pretty. Oh, I don't know what you've been told, but this guy right here is gonna rule the world. Yeah, that is what I'm gonna be, because I want to be. No, I don't want to sit still, look pretty. You get up on a... Marie Benedict went from lawyer to author to write historical novels inspired by women whose achievements have been overlooked or underappreciated. The New York Times bestselling author's latest book, Lady Clementine, tells the story of the woman beside British Prime Minister Winston Churchill. Her story is one of a partner who did not flinch through the darkness of war and who would not surrender either to expectations or to enemies. She also helped advance the women's suffrage movement and laid the groundwork for women in key leadership and military roles. Benedict views herself as an archaeologist of sorts, excavating forgotten or unknown women and bringing them into the light to help understand the contributions they've made and their pertinence to modern life. Benedict says she can trace her desire to tell untold stories of accomplished women back to when she was a girl.
It actually started, I can really trace it, to when I was in middle school, and I had this incredible aunt who was a English professor and a poet and a rebellious nun. And she was really determined to expose me to such a wide range of literature and voices. I was reading things that none of my friends were. And she gave me this book. Excuse me. It's called The Mists of Avalon by Marion Zimmer Bradley. And it was a retelling of the Arthurian legend from the perspective of the women. And that was completely groundbreaking for the time. It really opened up my eyes to the fact that there were all these voices, particularly women's voices, out there in history and myth and legend and lore, and I had never heard of them. And I started to ask myself how history was really formed and where were these other voices that I knew existed. I took a long detour in my path to actually capture those voices. I was a history major, but I ended up being a lawyer and a commercial litigator in New York City for a long time, until I just knew it wasn't the right fit for me. And I started to really listen to myself and that long sort of suppressed desire to excavate these women's stories from the past. And I started to walk down the path of writing these books. I had a foray into some other genres first, but when I wrote my first Marie Benedict book, The Other Einstein, that's when I knew I was doing sort of what I had been meant to do all along.
You know, I'm wondering, how did you sit through literature classes and history classes wondering where that other half was?
Well, I mean, throughout my years as a history major in college, I kept pushing the envelope on that. And I had a wonderful professor who I ended up doing a special project my senior year, which really focused on other voices in the past, which was something that people really weren't doing then. You know, we're starting to do that now. We're starting to rewrite that historical narrative. But in the years that followed, you know, even in my law work, I did some pro bono work kind of representing underrepresented voices. I did a project for a Native American group trying to get back some of artifacts that had been taken from their property. But I just knew that and I thought about being a history professor and an archaeologist when I went through those periods under my legal career when I knew I needed to do something else. But it wasn't really until I tried my hand at writing fiction in particular that I really felt I could best capture these voices and share them with as broad an audience as possible.
Makes sense. So let's start with The Other Einstein. Why did you pick her? And please talk about that book a bit. And then, of course, we'll get to your latest book. I mean, there's an enormous field of women to, in your word, excavate. How do you pick who you pick?
I really honestly have an enormous list that I keep running, and I return to it as I'm thinking about my next book. I really feel like, you know, when I made that decision to write historical fiction focusing on excavating the women, I feel like I developed almost like an antenna, for lack of a better descriptive word, and I started to see these women everywhere. They're literally hiding in plain sight, waiting for us to notice them, waiting for us to find them. And with that antenna, one evening I was reading, I have two sons, and one of my sons is a budding scientist, and we were reading a children's biography of Albert Einstein. And there were about two sentences about this young woman who was in his university physics program, who ended up being married to him during his most prolific period, the time that they call his miracle year. And of course, my antenna went crazy when I read those two sentences. And I went down the rabbit hole of research, which is what always happens when I'm intrigued by a particular woman. And I learned that she was far more interesting than I could have ever imagined, that I could have ever fictionalized. And that she had a story that was far beyond just being Albert Einstein's wife. She had her own unique, really meteoric rise from the backwater of 19th century Serbia, where it was actually illegal to attend high school if you were a girl, to becoming one of the very first women in a university physics program. Now, the fact that she happened to partner up with Albert Einstein, they had all the same classes and they ultimately got married, is just another part of her story. But she really had this unique, singular rise that I really felt deserved to be celebrated. And not to mention then, during the following years, I learned that, you know, she and Albert were scientific partners not only through their college years, but also in the years of their marriage. And they, in fact, were married during this most prolific period of his life when he published four groundbreaking theories that really revolutionized physics. It really created the foundation for modern physics. And if you read their letters, if you know her, you know she had a hand in that. And once I kind of realized the breadth and depth of her story, I knew I had to write The Other Einstein, which really captures that journey.
Okay, so that's based on Einstein's first wife, Mileva Maric. Who's next?
Oh, gosh. Then we moved to Carnegie's Maid, which is really probably the first and only time I'll write about a fictional woman. And the reason, so her story is the story of a young Irish immigrant woman who landed in Andrew Carnegie's home in Pittsburgh, where I'm from, and became his mother's lady's maid. His mother was a powerful force who was very involved in every aspect of his world. And she went on to influence Andrew Carnegie to become the world's first philanthropist and creator of the free library systems, which I've benefited from and my family has benefited from tremendously. I chose her story because my own family were Irish immigrants. They came to Pittsburgh, where I grew up, where I live now, and it was really the Carnegie Libraries of Pittsburgh which provided them with their first entree into education. You know, at the time period of the late 1800s, education was not mandatory, and those free libraries provided them with access to learning and books. And I wanted to kind of figure out why he had made this transformation, because it was so unique for the time period. And when I learned he had changed in the 1860s when he was a young man, when he was still living in Pittsburgh, and that historians had speculated that a woman, a relationship, had helped that transformation, it spawned the story that that lies behind Carnegie's Maid. And I had to fictionalize this woman because I looked for her and I couldn't find her, but I also wanted to sort of pay tribute to all those important immigrant women that really formed the foundation of our country, as well as the men, but whose stories are so rarely told.
Now let's move to another book, The Only Woman in the Room.
So I found Hedy Lamarr, who is the woman at the core of The Only Woman in the Room, when a dear anthropologist friend of mine mentioned this golden age of Hollywood actress that was also an inventor. So I dug deep into her life, and I realized that this woman who became the movie star that we know better as Hedy Lamarr was actually born a Jewish refugee in Austria in the early years of World War II. She ends up marrying an arms dealer who supplies munitions first to Mussolini and then to Hitler. And as she entertains hordes of military men and Mussolini and Hitler themselves, she's learning all the secrets of World War II. Strategies, plans, weapons designs, munitions. And as she escapes from this situation, she sees the writing on the wall for the Jewish people. She makes her way to Hollywood. And as she rises in the film industry, she decides she needs to strike out against Hitler because everything she has overheard is starting to come to fruition. She designs a weapon system to make torpedoes much more effective. She offers it to the Navy after she's patented it, and they refuse to utilize it. I think in large part because she was this beautiful woman, right, this movie star. But in fact, her invention was so innovative and so important that it was used in the years after the war for a variety of different military purposes, and ultimately became Wi-Fi, which we use every single day. So when I learned all this about her, both this incredible backstory, the real origin story about how she became the person that she was, and the legacy of her invention, I knew hers was a story that had to be told as well.
So is this the first book that you're writing about a woman who's not attached to a man, as it were?
You know, that's a really interesting point, and one that people ask me about. Yes. In the case of Hedy Lamarr, she is the first, not the only, as you'll see with some of my upcoming books, but it is the first woman I wrote about that isn't in someone else's shadow. You know, she really stood on her own two feet. She never allowed men to define her in any way, but society defined her. It really limited the person that she could become and the person that people perceived her to be. You know, she was really never during her lifetime allowed to be both a beautiful woman and a bright woman, an intelligent woman. You know, she was really in sort of the box that that society placed her in, and that's one of the reasons why her inventions were never accepted and celebrated in her lifetime.
Right, because you can't be both. You can't be bright and beautiful.
No,
right?
Of course not. How could you be both? That's crazy.
So moving along to Lady Clementine, your latest.
Before we get to her, I do kind of want to explain about my methodology, because it does probably seem random, because unlike a lot of other historical fiction writers, I'm not interested in one particular time period. You know, a lot of historical fiction writers will, you know, fall in love with a particular era and really stay right there. I'm interested in something different. I'm interested in very specific women. I'm interested in women who have made significant contributions that live on into the modern day, that really have a long-lasting legacy about which we're unaware. And I'm also looking for women who are struggling with modern-day issues. You know, for example, in each of the women that I select, they're dealing with issues that we are, as women today, still deal with. For example, with Mileva Marish Einstein, she's dealing with being a woman in science, right? And the pushback that she's getting. Hedy Lamarr, women in STEM. Each of these women is dealing with issues that really continue on, unfortunately, into the present day. And I was also interested in exploring women in different sort of subject matters. With Mileva Marish Einstein, we have a woman specifically in science and physics. With Carnegie's Maid, we have a woman who's dealing with philanthropy. With Hedy Lamarr, we have a woman in STEM. And with Clementine Churchill, we have a woman in politics. And as you'll see with the other books that are coming down the pike, I'm picking women in all sorts of different fields to kind of explore the issues that might resonate specifically from that field.
Okay, Lady Clementine.
You know, my antenna went a little bit crazy when I got close to her. When I was doing the research for World War II, for the only woman in the room. You can imagine, if you're doing World War II research, you're going to keep bumping into Winston Churchill, right? He's ubiquitous. Not just the cigar, the hat, the V for Victory sign, but his policies are really everywhere. And I'm not a Churchillian, as these people call themselves, who are big fans. I did know that he had a decades-long marriage, and I kept wondering, where is his wife? Right? You know, when you see these iconic images of Winston Churchill, he's always alone, or if anything, you might see him with FDR and Stalin. And I knew that he had this long marriage, supposedly a happy marriage, but I wondered where she was during all these key moments in modern history. And I wondered who she was. What was she doing during this time period? So again, I went down that crazy rabbit hole of research that I love to exist in, and I learned that she was far from the quintessential woman behind the man. She stood behind him, in front of him, holding his hand, leading him oftentimes to the correct decisions. She was, as Winston's chief of staff, General Pug Ismay, said after the war, he did not think that the history of Winston Churchill and the history of the world would have been the same without Clementine Churchill. And once I kind of read that and dug into her life, I knew that the story of this bold, courageous, contentious, sometimes difficult woman really deserved to be told, because we are living with her legacy today.
You know, you say you had to dig so much. Was this because of British history? You know, because you mentioned FDR, and I'm thinking, well, we know so much about Eleanor Roosevelt.
Certainly, in Britain, they do not have the sort of designated role of first lady, but like we have in the United States. the prime minister's wife doesn't have a specific role. But I think it really grows more out of a historical tradition. The prime minister's wife really wasn't involved in a lot of political endeavors. And that was kind of true across the board during this time period. Politicians' wives were rarely involved in either governmental work or the public eye. And so in kind of, you know, Clementine grew up as, she had a crazy upbringing that was not unlike Winston's in many ways. But, you know, she was had a keen interest in politics from her teenage years on. She was a strong advocate for women. She was really a suffragette in many ways, although she never engaged in any of the kind of direct action that, say, Emmeline Pankhurst's groups did. But she was really engaged with the world. And when she met Winston, she knew, she not only kind of fell in love with him, but she kind of fell in love with his mission to really make change in the world. And, you know, she'd had two engagements before that failed. And when she met him, I think she knew her society was never going to allow her to rise up and claim any kind of political space. I mean, women couldn't even vote. How could they serve, right, in any real capacity? And I think with Winston, she saw the chance to really step up and claim a political role that women were otherwise denied. And she did that in as the wife of, you know, not just the prime minister, but the home secretary, the Lord Admiral. Winston was in power from World War I through World War II, except for this 1930s wilderness years period. And as she served by his side, she really served. I mean, she was not only his advisor and confidant and guide in every aspect of his political realm, but she undertook all of these key projects on her own. She really didn't wait for people to invite her into history or into the political realm. She kind of rose up and claimed that space herself. But that wouldn't have been, she knew, a popular view at the time. So a lot of the work she did was kind of behind the scenes. It's interesting that you mention Eleanor Roosevelt because these women formed a really close bond during the war. And afterwards, they were friends. They visited each other, and I think they learned from each other. Eleanor really took some of the projects for women that Clementine was advocating in Britain and took them home here and put them into place. And Clementine learned how to become more of a public figure from Eleanor Roosevelt. You know, Eleanor was really unique in her time. America was probably a little bit more accepting of women in key roles. And Eleanor knew how to work the press. And Clementine really learned how to do that from Eleanor.
So what's next?
All right. So next January, I have a book coming out every January for the next 4 years. And the next January story is actually about Agatha Christie. You know, I've always been a fan, always fascinated with how this woman became really the most successful novelist, the most successful writer of all time. She sold more books than anybody else. And really the creator of this unique genre that lives on to today. And I learned that she actually disappeared for 11 days in the early part of her career. She had just published her third novel. And she disappeared in a way that was like torn from the pages of one of her books. They found her car running on the side of a cliff. She was nowhere to be seen. It launched the biggest manhunt in England's history. They enlisted Sir Arthur Conan Doyle to try and help find her. And then she just as mysteriously reappeared 11 days later. No one knows what happened to her during that time period. It was a tumultuous period in her life. And so I decided to dig deep into her background, to dig deep into this time period, and to try and reconstruct the story of what might have happened. You know, I look at all of my women as kind of my superheroes, and the books I write as their origin stories. And this book is no different than that. It kind of looks at all of these pieces and uses the structure of a mystery novel, not unlike Agatha Christie's, the unreliable narrator that she's so familiar with, that really she created in many ways, to write a story about a woman taking charge of her own narrative and writing her own history. So in many ways it's like all my other books, but in many ways it's quite different, both in terms of the genre structure and the way in which I'm having a woman reclaim her own history and her own power.
Okay, so do you find out what happened during those 11 days or why she disappeared?
You do. I mean, of course I write fiction. So it's my own fictional sense of what happened. Of course, I always believe what I write. But yes, you do find out what happens to her.
Interesting.
During that time period and then how that led to her really becoming the force that she was. The book that comes out 6 months after that, again, is a little bit unique. It's a co-written book with a wonderful author, Victoria Christopher Murray, and it's a book entitled The Personal Librarian. It explores the role that this incredible librarian, art historian, and curator, Bella DaCosta Green, played when J.P. Morgan created the Morgan Library in New York City. If you've ever been there, it's a jewel box, beautiful structure, and it actually today holds the world's best collection of medieval manuscripts. During her lifetime, she had a close relationship with J.P. Morgan. Even after his death, she became the most powerful person in the art world and certainly the most successful career woman of her time. But she was only able to do this because she hid her true identity. Although she passed as white, she was actually African-American. And she not only had to hide her true identity, by the time period, you know, we're talking about the years after the Civil War, when segregation was starting to become the law of the land. She not only had to hide her identity, she also had to hide her heritage. Her father was a very important civil rights activist in the years after the Civil War. He was the first African-American man to graduate from Harvard. He was the dean of Howard Law School, and he was the advocate of the Civil Rights Act of 1875, which if it had not been overturned in the 1890s, we would have never had segregation. So it's a really interesting exploration of this really powerful, unknown woman, but also a deep dive into a really important history, a really important piece of American history.
You know, I wanted to ask you, why introduce fiction into nonfiction research? And you're so interested in the women and making sure readers know about them and not just the men. Why use a fictional element? Why incorporate fiction?
Right. It's a great question. It's one a lot of people are curious about, particularly because I do such a vast amount of research, you know, and my books really are anchored in historical research, even though there is quite a bit of fiction. I think probably there are two key reasons. First, for a lot of the women I research, and for a lot of historical women in general, it isn't until very recently that we have considered women's stories, women's histories, women's documentation, evidence of their life worthy of keeping and retelling. So when you go back into the past and you're trying to reconstruct a woman's life, especially if you're going to do it from a biographical perspective, it's very hard sometimes to actually cobble together the full story. You know, a man in a similar situation, every scrap of detail about their lives would have been kept. I really ran into this a lot with the Maleva Marish Einstein. You know, if Albert Einstein blew his nose in the tissue, we have kept that tissue. But Maleva Marish Einstein, who was incredible in her own right, there are very few artifacts left of her life. So in order to paint a really full picture of these women's lives, sometimes you need to insert a certain amount of fiction. Now, fiction, the way I look at it, is really a logical extrapolation of the facts. You know, I spent a lot of years as a lawyer in which part of my job was to dig deep into the research, tie all those pieces together with the logic that you develop as a lawyer in order to create a narrative on behalf of your client. And really, in some ways, these stories are no different. I'm digging deep into the research, and I'm knitting together a story on behalf of my client, which is these women. So that's really one of the primary reasons that I've chosen to do fiction. I think the other is, you know, we don't always know what happens, right? These are fictional stories. But we can't get into the woman's, you know, I write in the first person. And it's very hard as a reader to get into their mind, their lives, their thoughts, the arc of their existence, unless you can get there. And you can't do that really as a biographer. I mean, there's many talented biographers out there who are attempting this. But I think from my perspective, I found it more fulfilling and I found myself more capable of getting into the interior of these women's lives in a way that I hope connects with readers. I found it easier to do that through fiction. I do understand why some people might find it to be more powerful to be done in a biographical nonfiction setting. But for me, kind of reaching into the arc of these women's life is best served through fiction.
And it underscores your point about the dearth of artifacts and facts, you know, the dearth of information. So you plug in the holes with fiction.
Exactly. Right. And sometimes there's a lot of questions in these women's lives that we're never going to know the answer. Like, we will never actually know the extent to which Maleva Marish Einstein helped write those four foundational theoretical physics papers, right? We really will never know the answer to that. But I also think the preconception up until now, that the way that people perceived that is that she probably didn't. Prove to me that she did do it. But I really feel like once you know these women and you know their strengths and you know their capabilities, the question shouldn't be prove to me that they did these things, right? The question should be prove to me that they didn't, right? If you know women and you know their capabilities, you know that the chances are more likely than not that they played a key role. But sometimes we don't have the hardcore evidence necessary to prove that. But why shouldn't we write these stories answering the question in the affirmative, right? Answering the question as to did they? Yes, they did.
That was author Marie Benedict talking about her works of historical fiction. Her latest book, Lady Clementine, a fictionalized biography, was recently released in paperback. August 26th marked the 100th anniversary of the ratification of the 19th Amendment, and the National Women's History Museum launched Women Vote, Women Win, a nonpartisan initiative designed to honor the legacy of suffragists and all of the women since who have worked to secure voting rights for women. Running through the end of the year, the initiative will explore the historical context of the 19th Amendment, the critical work that continued after its passage to ensure all women had the right to vote, and contemporary issues around voting through programming, partnerships, resources, conversations, and voter engagement activities.
Hurrah! Hurrah! For equal rights! Hurrah! Hurrah for the suffrage flag that bears the woman's star! This band is for all reforms, war shall be at an end. Bayonets and swords shall rust, we'll use the brain, the pen. Laden with precious freight, now thunders on the progress car. At the headlight waves a suffrage flag that bears the woman's star.
That's our show for this week. Thanks to Tina Rennick for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1624.